Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Tech is provided by AOL Radio at AOL.com/podcasting. This is TWiT, This Week in Tech, episode 164, for October 13th, 2008. Release the McCracken! This Week in Tech is brought to you by Audible.com. For your free copy of the first story of the Audible exclusive Metatropolis, go to audible.com/twitmeta. And by GoToMeeting. For your free 30-day trial, visit gotomeeting.com/twit. And by listeners like you. Thanks so much for your contribution. We couldn't do TWiT without it. This is TWiT This Week in Tech, and a great panel to get today. Kind of a different panel. One newbie, and I'll introduce him first. Scott Rosenberg has never been with us before. Former print journalist who left the print world to help co-found Salon. Gosh, almost more than 10 years ago now, Scott. It's amazing.
Well, got to 12, 13, 1995. However, how many years is that?
Crazy.
I can't count.
Crazy. And Salon's still going strong. In fact, stronger than ever during this election year. It's really become a resource during the election year of great information. And now is working on a book. He wrote Dreaming in Code, which is a great book. And now working on a new one about the story of blogging from beginning to end.
Well, we don't actually know where the end is. So for beginning till the present,
the middle,
and wherever we are now.
Yeah, that's an interesting job to tackle, I would imagine. I mean, it's kind of an amorphous subject, as I'm sure you.
It starts out somewhat manageably, because of course you start with a handful of people, and then over time it explodes and becomes this kind of the tidal wave of stuff. And at that point, you know, you really have to be very selective and say, what are some key events? What are some key people? And what does it all mean, really? It becomes less about what happened and more about, you know, how did all of this stuff change the way we live and the way we use the web and so on?
Well, this is, and again, the election, it's huge. Harry McCracken is also here. Is that you, Harry?
It was. I was wondering if Scott is even attempting to determine who the first blogger was, given that I'm not sure anybody knows for sure.
Well, you know, it seems like there are so many claimants to it, and that it's kind of goes back at this point. The easy way out of that is to just say that the first website that Tim Berners-Lee set up had a reverse chronological list of new websites.
There you go.
And that, you know,
that's a
blog. You can say that. And that kind of preempts all the other people.
Also, so that's Harry McCracken of Technologizer, another print fugitive, although a little more recent, former editor-in-chief at PC World Magazine. Technologizer is his new, dare I say, blog, Harry?
I keep wavering back and forth on whether I claim I am a blogger or I'm not. I mean, ultimately, it's all just about whether the content is worth reading. But I am in reverse chronological order, and I guess if that's the definition of blogging, then I am one.
Yeah, that's a problem. I don't know what a blog is anymore. I mean, they're all just websites. But Technologizer, the last time we talked, Harry, you hadn't launched it yet. It's now launched, a smarter take on tech, and great stuff, great information.
Thank you.
Yeah, I'm really enjoying it. It's I think it's right on. I hope you do well with it, because it's a very useful site and really, you know, good reading, which is probably the most important thing.
Things are going well, and the best part about doing it is I actually get to do the stuff I got into this business for, which is to touch stuff and use products and to write about them and to start a conversation.
Right. That's the fun stuff. Also with us, Tom Merritt, who is no stranger to TWiT from Buzz Out Loud. Tom, you're not a fugitive from anything.
I try not to be, mostly because I'm not a member of anything.
So there's nothing to flee.
That I have to then flee from.
There's nothing to flee. But you have done print, you've done television, you've done web, and now you're doing that.
I have done GeoCities homepages.
Nothing to be proud of. Angel Fire.
I've done Blink Text. I've done Tripod.
The top story of the week, I guess, is going to be a story that really breaks on Tuesday. Apple did, in fact, send out the email on Tuesday, as it is wont to do, saying, come to our event on October, what is it going to be, the 14th And it said the spotlight is on notebooks. So clearly this is going to be the announcement of the MacBooks. I know, Harry, you've written a little bit about it. In fact, you've got a great post saying, let's build an $800 MacBook, since that's one of the rumors, is that there'll be one that cheap. Tom, what do you think Apple's going to announce?
Well, for once, they took all the wind out of our sails, right? And put notebooks right there in the the invitation. And then they said, we'll put the spotlight on notebooks. And so then we caught ourselves going like, what does that mean? Is it talking about search? Like, you know, you can overparse these things. I think they're going to come out with a refresh line of notebooks. You know, we'll see a new MacBook Pro, a new MacBook. It's been a while since they really totally revitalized that line. The $800 notebook rumor sounds reasonable to me. In these economic times, they might try to like put out a midway point between like a cheap notebook and a MacBook. The MacBook Air is their portable, but it's way too expensive. So maybe it's more of an Asus EPC competitor. Who knows?
This time around, I think the rumor sites have been very active and probably accurate as well. They say three new MacBooks. One of them might be that inexpensive $800 MacBook. Two MacBook Pros, one of them, or maybe both, might be the one carved out of a solid brick of aluminum, which might as well be solid gold for all the cost that that'll be. And then two new MacBook Airs. Harry, is it possible that they're making a brick? Is that...
You know, I wish I knew enough about manufacturing processes to have something smart to say. I've seen some people who do know about manufacturing saying that actually the brick is not a particularly innovative idea, and some of those things are happening already. I do know that we know that Steve Jobs hates seams and imperfections. And he's for many, many years, decades even, he's been trying to build computers that look like they're carved out of a solid brick of something. So I think the idea would be appealing.
Now, he'd like to not have any buttons from some things I've read.
No screen, just a solid piece of aluminum that somehow.
I mean, he once said that the bottoms of Mac laptops look better than the tops of everybody else's computers, which is true. They even care about how the battery fits in and whether there are any seams there.
Right. I think it's exactly the kind of thing his ego would fall for.
I don't envy anyone having to unveil a new product line in the face of the current news, you know, to say, hey, here are a bunch of laptops and some of them are going to be expensive. And oh, by the way, you know, have you looked at the Dow today?
How do you say, here's a $3,100 notebook? Enjoy.
Although, you know, you have to remember that the original iPod was announced right after 9/11 at a far lower point.
True.
And actually, maybe the timing of that was good because it gave us something else to think about.
Well, and he's not, well, we don't know yet, but we're not expecting anything crazy new. I know there was the Calcanis interview on CNET UK where he told Nate Langson that they have an HD TV in the works that would have an Apple TV built into
it. That's completely credible, don't you think? I don't think he'll announce it this time.
I don't think you'll see that announcement now because this is a bad time to hit a whole new product line. Right. But refreshing the MacBook line, you kind of have to do that. It's the right time to do it. Actually, a little earlier this year might have been even better. But it's the kind of announcement that if you're going to hear one, I would guess I would expect.
Mm-hmm. Harry, was it possible to build an 800 MacBook?
I think it's entirely possible. I mean, the current MacBook, which sells for $1,100, has been around for about 2.5 years. And today's $800 computer is what an $1,100 computer was back then. So my guess would be you'll see an $800 one, which is roughly comparable to the current MacBook, which will open up room in the line for a new aluminum MacBook, which is maybe $1,100 or $1,200, plus a revise of the MacBook Pro, which is actually a design which is very comparable to what PowerBooks were like in terms of the industrial design 5 years ago.
Right.
And then maybe a modest update of the MacBook Air, nothing radically different, but a new CPU. And I do think that Apple, there's always a delta between PCs and Macs in terms of how much RAM and hard drive size and so forth you get at a certain price point. That delta has gotten wider lately. And I think that if all they do is give people a little more RAM and a little more hard drive space at each price point, it will help. And that would, in fact, be a message which is kind of consistent with economic challenges if Macs start to sound like better bargains than they are right now.
Isn't it amazing, Scott, how much attention Apple is able to kind of garner from these. I mean, it's just a notebook.
Really? It seems like, you know, Steve Jobs is maybe the only person. Well, he certainly gets more attention than President Bush at this point. I mean,
yes,
President Bush,
absolutely.
You know, he's got a press conference. He has an address to the nation at this point, and no one cares. You know, I guess, you know, in a sense, Steve is sort of an opportunity at this point to just focus the mind on something that, you know, people care, you know, people, they have a passion for Apple, they have a passion right. for the product, and they don't have to think about this painful reality.
We've seen a lot of leaked pictures so far. I don't know how, you know, their provenance or how accurate they are, but we've seen a lot of leaked pictures of these, and there's some speculation on some sides that maybe because of the position of the ports on these parts, the movement from the front to the side of the CD-ROM, that maybe this will be a dockable MacBook. I'm sure Tom Merritt, all the crazies who write to Buzz Out Loud have proposed this, right? They certainly have. The crazies who visit my chat room have proposed this, that you might they might make a screen looking that looks like an iMac but has no guts that you slide. This doesn't seem on the face of it very, very credible, to be honest with you, that you slide the MacBook into like a toaster and then suddenly you've got a desktop. Apple tried this before with the Duo. I don't know if this is really a...
Yeah, I've heard the dock rumors. I've heard the tablet rumors. Those are kind of the two far out there, but at least in the ballpark of a notebook.
Why
announced
not a netbook? Aren't the netbooks the hottest things out there right now? You've got that new Lenovo. You've got the amazing Asus S101. You've got the Dell, everybody's doing these little 2-pound, simple, and it seems like that's Apple's territory.
Yeah, I think, well, that's why I think that's what the $800 computer will be. It'll be their netbook.
Because, but it's twice as much as the other guys.
Well, and there you go. and fits the pattern.
Maybe you're right. So you think it'll be a netbook?
Yeah, I do. I think the $800 one will be sort of a, well, we have the MacBook Air as our netbook, but, you know, but for some people it's too expensive and it's too limited. And so we know you want ports and we know sometimes you want a CD-ROM drive in there. So we've got this new whatever they call it at the $800 price point.
Yeah. What any surprises you think at all on Tuesday? Somebody in our chat room, and I thought it was a great rumor, and I'd almost like to upload it to CNN's iReport. Somebody in the chat room said Steve Jobs will announce his retirement and future plans for Apple on Tuesday.
I suspect when that day comes, he's not going to do it in front of a room of reporters, most likely.
You think?
After announcing netbooks, no.
After announcing netbooks, right.
Oh, one more thing. I'm out of here.
That's the one more thing.
I'm gone.
After what Scott was just saying, people may pay more attention to Apple than President Bush. Maybe he'll announce a run for the presidency.
Yeah, I wouldn't put it past Steve. It's the kind of thing he might consider.
Let's combine those rumors.
He would have to reveal his full health records, though.
Oh, yes.
Yep, done. No, you're right.
He could get that doctor who checked out McCain.
That's true.
The guy who
didn't,
he just said.
And McCain actually hasn't revealed his full health record, right. So you can do it.
Yeah, you can get away with it.
Sites lately have gotten to be better about figuring out almost everything a little early. I think it's probably the last time that anything was strikingly new and unreported were the details about the iPhone. Which was almost 2 years ago. And even then, everybody knew there would be an iPhone, but they did manage to keep.
But don't you think that gets under Steve's skin and that he will find ways to you know, he'll just do something to spite those sites? He'll find things, you know, if not this time, next time, sooner or later, he's going to stick it to them.
I'd love to think so. I mean, you kind of wonder whether at some point Apple might release false rumors just to get people excited about the wrong thing.
Yeah.
I'm not sure Apple hasn't done that already here or there. Because around the time of the iPhone, there were some pretty cool looking pictures that got out. And then there were some faked stuff. And it was hard to tell truth from rumor. And it ended up that there were so many rumors that even if some of them were true, it was hard to tell which ones had been right.
Nicholas Ciarelli, the guy who started Think Secret and was hounded out of business by Apple and Apple's lawyers, a couple of weeks ago did a survey of Mac rumor sites. And he said the consensus is that no, Apple hasn't been fighting leaks this year. He said nobody's received a letter from Apple. Nobody's gotten in trouble. There's no doubt, he says, that Apple has changed. He says Jeremy Horowitz, editor-in-chief of iLounge, told me in an email, probably due to the awful PR its prior lawsuits generated and because cease and desist letters only confirm links, Apple has wisely stopped going after the people who generate its buzz. That would be a real change.
Maybe that part of the campus that had the fire was the department that the went lawyers. After rumors.
That's where the lawyers were. Oh, we don't have a desk. Oh, well, that's enough of that.
Forget it. Let the rumors fly.
Yeah.
It's certainly true that when Apple tells you to take down photos you've put up on your rumor site, that is the closest thing to an absolute confirmation.
Yeah, confirms it.
It's probably self-defeating.
Apple's got so much mileage, though, out of this secrecy, this penchant for secrecy. It really has amped up the interest in what they're going to announce. But I think we're finding it's a little hard for us to even whip up any excitement over this. So we'll just leave the matter and wait till Tuesday. We'll be covering it live. I'm going to go down there with a camera crew of one, and we'll cover it. And usually when they do these events at One Infinite Loop, they have a little demo room next door that you can go to. This is the last few times they've done that, and see the products. I'm hoping they'll do that, and if they can, we'll stream live video of that.
What is the quality of announcement of a One Infinite Loop versus a Moscone Center?
Well, isn't that interesting? Moscone Center, that was the last one, was for the big iPod announcement, although the original iPod announcement was at One Infinite Loop.
And the last One Infinite Loop that I can remember, and I think I might be missing one, though, was the Hi-Fi.
Yeah. That was stupid. And the sock, an Apple iPod case that was really just a sock.
Yeah.
And it came in colors. That was the silliest announcement ever. But that was one where in fact, remember they had, they really were elaborate. They had different rooms of the house, like a living room and a bedroom and a kitchen and a student's, room with bunk beds. And each one would have the Apple Hi-Fi in it. It was a really silly. I don't know if they'll do that this time, but it is true that they're not going to go up to Moscone. They're going to do it at this much smaller venue. So Richard Garriott, he's Lord British, right?
Yeah.
He's in space right now as we speak.
Without a toilet.
There's no toilet. On Sunday, about 3 in the morning, he was blasted off in a Soyuz TMA-13 capsule, which, by the way, shows amazing bravery. To go up in a Soviet-era rocket alongside U.S. astronaut Michael Fink and Russian cosmonaut Yuri Lonkakov. They will circle the Earth a few times before docking with the International Space Station. He will at that time conduct, this is according to Gizmodo, a series of experiments. I don't know what, but they say they will probably not include level grinding. Although level grinding in space might produce a smoother, finer character in the long.
How does tabula rasa work in space?
Exactly. Apparently that $19 million toilet isn't really working. So
I bet the latency up there is horrible too.
He's a space tourist, right? How much does it cost to do this? Is it like $1 million?
I think it's more like 20 million. I interviewed Charles Simonyi, because he did this too, from
Microsoft. Yeah.
Microsoft. He's going a second time. He liked it so much. Yeah. And I'm pretty sure the figure was somewhere, something like 20, 24 million. It was not cheap.
I guess there's more money in role-playing adventures than I thought.
Yeah. According to AFP, 30 million.
Whoa.
So it's gone up since Simonyi.
Inflation.
Wow. Space tourism.
Richard Garriott's dad was an astronaut.
Oh, really?
So maybe he was able to wrangle a discount of some sort.
Oh, I didn't know that. So he wanted to do what his dad had done. That's kind of neat. That's the ultimate adventure. Do you think he'll write maybe a sci-fi adventure based on space? I think that's pretty cool. One of ours is up there.
His dad went up on Skylab back in 1973.
Really? I didn't know that. Was his name Garriott also?
Owen Garriott.
I'll be darned.
So he's essentially donating money to the development of the space
program.
Good
for him.
I mean,
somebody's got to do it.
Some people complain like, oh, he could be doing so much more with this money than just wasting it on a trip into space. But they're essentially letting him do it to fund the continuation of their program.
That's okay. And $30 million probably isn't much. It's probably, one tank of fuel. So the new Google Sat, which is not GOI-1, is up, and we're seeing the first image from it, a bird's eye view of Kutztown University in Pennsylvania. It is the world's highest resolution commercial satellite. Google, among other users for its Google Maps. Boy, the picture looks amazing. It is really crystal clear. Looks like an aerial photo from a plane.
Well, yeah, what's that guy reading there?
Looks like The Onion, actually. I can't quite tell. GOI-1 has a big Google sticker on it, but actually its main customer is the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency. So it is kind of a national security satellite. But Google is going to buy the images from it. It'll be part of Google Maps.
I think they have exclusive rights to them, right?
Do they? The commercial rights, non-spy rights?
Yeah, they get any of the 50-centimeter images, and then I think it can do as good as 41-centimeter, but those are off-limits for public use.
What is that when they say centimeter? Does that mean how the resolution?
Each pixel, I just learned this from a Buzz Out Loud listener this week, each pixel represents 41 centimeters in 41-centimeter resolution.
Okay. 41 centimeters, that's 2 feet, right? Something like that. So
41 centimeters.
Something close.
Yeah.
So
100 centimeters.
You couldn't read a newspaper. You might be able to read a license plate. You could read a billboard. The main thing is they just look. Yeah. The image really looks nice. I mean, it's just it's a looks crisper. You know, it's like they have better lenses or something on that thing. Google's 10th anniversary was last month, and their Google phone is coming out in a week. They're really becoming almost an extra national institution with their own spy satellite.
Seriously, an NGO.
They're an NGO. they're really. I don't know. Are you? Does that bother anybody? Scott Rosenberg, do you have your eye on Google while it has its eye on you?
I think we should all. It behooves all of us to be a little cautious, a little concerned. I mean, you know, the motto "Don't be evil" has all of this kind of. It makes people feel good. People love Google because you know the homepage is clean and they don't throw lousy pop-up ads in your face and all these. You know, they've got all this goodwill, but all the goodwill in the world doesn't really matter when someone has a huge amount of power and you don't have any, you know, transparency on it. I mean, Google remains an incredibly closed institution. Ask, you know, I mean, all the people who have beefs with their advertising system, it's really hard to kind of deal with them. Google is, you know, all set up to have machines talk to machines, and that works great for them, but it's not a very, you know, sort of people talking to people kind of a company. So I think caution is definitely called for.
Witness the flap we had over getting their privacy policy linked from the front page.
Right.
They seem above
the law. You know, we don't have to do that, even though the state of California says so.
And then they finally begrudgingly figured out how to drop one word to another page so they could make room for the privacy word and link that right next to the copyright symbol.
Well, at least they're not listening in on our phone sex. They're leaving that to the NSA.
Not yet.
Maybe they are. We just don't know about it.
They'll allow you to search it. They just don't listen.
A Navy linguist, David Murphy Falk, intercept operator, said that intercept operators shared a number of titillating conversations while eavesdropping at the NSA on phone calls made by U.S. military personnel. He told ABC, there's good phone sex or there's some pillow talk. Pull it up. It's really funny.
Now, this is in the Inquirer.
It's actually from the anecdote is from the new book by James Bamford, okay, who is the world's greatest expert on the NSA. His first book was called The Puzzle Palace. It came out like 20, 30 years ago.
And basically, it
revealed it exposed the NSA to the world. And he is an amazing writer and researcher. I haven't read the book yet. His new book is called The Shadow Factory. And this detail is from it, although the Inquirer did not mention that.
No. Although the Senate, chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee says he's going to investigate these allegations. Yeah. So they took it seriously.
But it should be, I think, given that Bamford is the source, it should be taken seriously. And I am not, you know, I can't say, having read his first book, that I'm surprised.
Yeah.
It's the least surprising thing in the world. It would have been amazing if stuff like this didn't happen.
It's the flippancy of the quote that really gets you. I mean, Falk says, there's good phone sex or there's some pillow talk. Pull it up. It's really funny.
It's good. Shadow Factory comes out next week, by the way. So that might end up being our Audible pick when that comes out on audio. I'd love to listen to that. I mean, listening to Legacy of Ashes right now. And it's really kind of mind-boggling to hear what these government agencies are doing in the name of security. But of course they're doing that. You get some young guys. I don't care if they have a security clearance. They're going to do that. There's something hot going on. Hey, listen to this. You won't believe it.
Hey, no harm, right? You know, you're just listening in for a little bit of fun.
It's a little creepy.
It's real creepy. It's the kind of thing you assume goes on logically, but then somewhere in the back of your mind, you're like, oh, but it can't be. Really?
Yeah.
But it really does.
It's why you need courts to have some kind of oversight over this stuff, and why that, you know, that battle is still really important.
The FISA court or somebody, though, because you got to keep it secret still, right? You can't let everybody know what the NSA is up to, or it loses some of its potency.
Fine, but at least the FISA court.
At least FISA, yeah. We're going to take a little break. As long as I mentioned Audible, I want to actually talk about some new book that Audible is allowing you guys to download free. It is a special exclusive to Twit listeners, and I am really excited. I've been listening to it all week secretly. It's called Metatropolis. Let me tell you a little bit about Audible.com first. Audible is, of course, the premier source of audio recordings, books, lectures, debates, speeches. I love Audible. 51,000 titles and counting. And now they're doing a lot of exclusive stuff. This is the new sci-fi book that Audible commissioned. It's called Metatropolis. I love the idea. They took five of the top sci-fi authors in the world. Jay Lake, Michael Hogan, Tobias Buckel, and actually those are the narrators. I'm sorry. I'm giving you the guys. The authors are John Scalzi, who edited the piece as well, Elizabeth Baer, Jay Lake, Tobias Buckel, Carl Schroeder. And the idea was all these guys got together first and gals got together first to create a new world, a kind of a dystopia in the near future called Metatropolis, a world where the big cities are dying or transformed. And the suburbs are now the treacherous wilds. It's actually a really timely book. I'm reading the first. And then they wrote five novellas around this world. So they're not collaborating. They only collaborated in the creation of the world. And then they said, okay, now go out and now write a novella on it. And they went out and they got narrators from Battlestar Galactica to read it. And I'm reading the first one. We're going to give it to you free. Saul Teig of Battlestar Galactica, Michael Hogan, reads the first one in The Forest of the Night, written by Jay Lake. I'm going to play a little bit of it for you. It is so good. I invite you to go to our special URL, audible.com/twitmeta, TWITMETA, and you're going to be able to download the first story absolutely free. You don't have to have a credit card. No geographic restrictions. We listened to you, and I know some people were upset that some of the books we talk about aren't available worldwide. This is available worldwide, whether you're an existing customer, a new customer, or no customer at all. All you need to do is submit your email address and your create a password. No credit card. So you're going to go to audible.com/twitmeta, and I'm going to play a little bit of Saul Teig reading this. This I tell you, I'm loving this book. You're going to like it, Tom. It might be something for Sword and Laser. I don't think there's a print version of it. I think it's only for audible.com. It's exclusive. Let me see if I can find the. This is from the
first
story.
It would be nice to say that Tiger arrived in Cascadiopolis on the wings of a storm, riding the boiling front of electric darkness and lashing rain like a tall, handsome man out of some John Ford Western, or that he came through shadow and fire by a secret tunnel through the honeycombed basalt bones of these green-covered mountains, a hero out of templed legend following the journey of the gods. It would be nice, but inaccurate. Tiger arrived the way almost everyone comes to Cascadiopolis, either by accident, by judicial design, or by following the damp silences between the trees higher and higher until there was nowhere left to go.
Cascadiopolis is in the Pacific Northwest. It's a green community created by, I just love it. Some great.
Just follow the damp silences till you see the open spaces. Take a right.
They'll be there. Michael Hogan's reading that one. Colonel Saul Teig. Candace McClure, Officer Anastasia D. Douala on Battlestar Galactica also reads one. Stefan Rudnicki and Scott Brick, two of their best narrators from Audible. And Alessandro Giuliani, who is Lieutenant Felix Gaeta.
That was really kind of distracting, actually, to hear Colonel Ty.
I know. It's a little, you know what? He is good.
The old man wouldn't put up with
yeah,
it.
Yeah. He's really good on this book. You've got, look, just take my word for it. Twit meta is the keyword. So go to audible.com/twitmeta and download it. And I think you'll get hooked. And I'm not sure how soon the full book is available. You could pre-order it now, but you will be able to hear the first novella from it. Jay Lake wrote this. I have not read any Jay Lake stories, and I'm going to read more. He is really good. And by the way, it's political. It really is timely. It's really kind of the aftermath of the great, you know, economic upheaval and destruction of the American economy. I just loved it. October 21st, the book comes out. So you're going to get a preview. This is exclusive, by the way. We're not promoting this anywhere else. Audible's not promoting it anywhere else. They want to see if there's anybody listening. Audible.com/twitmeta. If the site hasn't gone down, go there right now, because I think there are a few people listening. It is really good. And we thank Audible for their support of This Week in Tech. So maybe the NSA, we could get them to stop listening to the phone calls and start listening to more audiobooks. Court has banned the sales of Real DVD. This is Real Network's attempt to make a DVD ripping program that was legal. Judge Marilyn Hall Patel, remember her from Napster, has ruled that a temporary restraining order blocking sales of the software will stay place indefinitely until she figures out whether it violates the DMCA.
This story just kills me. Right now, you can go to download.com or freaking Google, search for DVD ripping software. Yeah. You can find hundreds of titles. There's a great one called Mac Drive-In that does exactly the same thing, but that's fine. We can allow those.
But this is Real Networks, and they better not do that.
And when Real Networks comes and tries to do it with added protection and efforts to try to get licensing and cooperate, then they get slammed down and thrown in the court.
Do they? Is it because the movie industry has to do this? No.
Well, if they had to do it, why wouldn't they do it with all these other programs?
Because they're often offshore. They can't find these guys.
Yeah, they're not companies that are legal targets the way a real company, pardon the pun, like Real is. You know,
and Real tried to play the game by the law, and I think it's real shame. No pun intended.
They did. They went. Didn't Rob Glaser go to the movie industry and say we're going to make this work? And what do you think? And
their hope was that that Hollywood would say, maybe we can sell, you know, if somebody rips their copy of The Godfather Part 1, maybe we can sell them Part 2 and Part 3 through Real DVD. but Real ended up suing Hollywood preemptively the day the software came out, and then Hollywood sued them later the same day. And I think it's kind of a shame because this is – I actually think it's a pretty good product, but it's also a product which is inherently crippled to please Hollywood. Once you've ripped a movie onto a hard drive, you cannot move that to another hard drive. You can't put these things on your home network, let alone on BitTorrent. And even that wasn't enough to satisfy Hollywood.
So the point of this is that people want to get their DVDs on their computer so they can fly somewhere so that they can – it's just more convenient. Hollywood said, well, the problem with this is you could rent a movie, rip it, and then bring the movie back. Can they do that, Harry?
You could do that. Yeah. I mean, there would be nothing preventing you from doing that.
So I guess that's a loophole. I could understand. They may not.
It's a loophole. But, if you fix every loophole, if you wait until every loophole has been eradicated, then nothing will ever happen. And you would think that Hollywood would want all these people and all these DVDs to jump into the digital age a little more quickly.
Why doesn't an executive sitting in, you know, one of these buildings in Hollywood say, well, wait a minute. As you pointed out, it's easy to do this illegally. It's trivial. Anybody can do it.
I mean, they finally are getting it with MP3s. They tried to kill the MP3. And today you can go to Amazon and buy, you know,
unlocked MP3s.
Unlocked songs, which you could immediately turn around.
Has that put the music industry out of business?
No. It's one of the few pieces of bright news there is out there for the music industry.
And I don't know. I mean, I'm looking at Flip for Mac's website. They make the drive-in software that I just mentioned. They have their company addressed right there.
Oh, Flip for Mac's a legitimate company. Yeah.
Telestream Inc., Nevada City, California. They're doing exactly the same piece of software as Real, just runs on a Mac. No trouble.
Well, now they're in trouble. You busted them, dude. I forgot about that drive-in program. Yeah, that's not like shrink to five or anything.
No, it's not a fly-by-night thing. That's a legit program.
This is a big company. So their drive-in allows you to take a DVD, put it in the drive, rip it to your hard drive, and watch it.
It's a bit doing the same thing as Real. It's doing bit for bit copy, and then I think it even encrypts that copy so that you can't, you know, you're limited with what you can do with it. It's following all the rules of the, what was the case that was won a while back? Kaleidoscape.
Oh, this is the DVD jukebox.
Yeah.
Which is very similar, except it costs like $30,000 or $40,000.
And the court said, it wasn't the movie industry that said okay. It was the courts that said it's okay. So the idea was you got 300 DVDs or whatever. You put them in this jukebox. It copies them to the hard drive. Now you take the DVDs out and you can watch it on the jukebox.
Although they never ruled on whether that was a violation of copyright laws. It had to do with the licensing agreements that the Kaleidoscape people had with Hollywood on the DVD encryption software.
Yeah, so you have to unprotect a movie to play it. Every DVD player can do that.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Every DVD player program can do that on your computer. But they do that by license with Hollywood?
Mm-hmm. That's right. I mean, if you couldn't decrypt this stuff, then nobody could ever watch it in any form.
Right.
And the Kaleidoscape people had a license to do that, and I assume Real did too. And with Kaleidoscape, it was proven that if what Kaleidoscape was doing, which is very similar to Real DVD, was not a violation of the license they had. But the court did not say, okay, this is not a violation of copyright law.
Right, and that's what this judge is saying, is I have to decide if this circumvents the DMCA. And that's a really key question here, because you're not cracking the encryption. You're doing a bit for bit. And if doing that violates the DMCA, that means pretty much anytime you make a copy of something that someone attempted to copy protect, you're violating the DMCA.
And
even
the real
if the copy
copies,
protection isn't good, yeah.
Which sort of is what the DMCA says, doesn't it? I mean,
they don't believe in fair use.
Yeah, there's no exemption for fair use in the DMCA.
And that would be a fair use application, making a copy of something you already own for backup purposes would be fair use.
Well,
it should be, but the DMCA doesn't explicitly say that.
There is no fair use.
I think it is fair use, but it still violates the DMCA.
Right. The DMCA doesn't allow for fair use.
Yeah, there's no, and we're actually on Buzz Out Loud, we're trying to get a couple of people who are patent lawyers in the audience to submit fair use as a proposed exemption to the DMCA to the Library of Congress, because they're taking suggestions right now.
Oh, good. So that's good. I'd like to support that. Go to bol.cnet.com.
Yeah, go to the forums, forums.cnet.com. Look for Frank Latuca's posting about it. That's where he's trying to get it together.
Good. I mean, maybe that's the kind of thing that might make a difference. Just little grassroots.
You never know. I mean, the chances of them accepting it as an exemption are pretty slim, but it's worth a shot.
Well, you got to figure, and it's terrible, but it's probably true. You got to figure that the copyright royalty board, just before they, you know, they see that, okay, good. Let me just call my friend at Universal and see what he thinks. You got to figure they do that, right?
It's possible.
Let's just see what the MPAA says before we rule. We don't want to make any mistakes. A Russian security firm, Elcomsoft, says we can now use NVIDIA video cards in PCs to speed up the cracking of WPA keys. This is the encryption used on wireless networking, thought to be uncrackable. We could speed it up 100 times faster, fast enough that we think that in most cases we could brute force your WPA key in just a matter of days. Now, I think this is just Elcomsoft's trying to sell software here. They're proclaiming it's the death of wireless networking and business networks. And I guess that would be true if you were General Motors and you were worried about Toyota doing industrial espionage. There would be some incentive to sit outside, you know, company headquarters, download a bunch of data, and spend a week or two cracking it. But nobody's going to do that to your home Wi-Fi.
Isn't it a legal problem now for a big, any decent sized company where now that they've said that this can be cracked, you know, even if it's sort of a dubious claim or debatable, Their lawyers are going to say, well, you know, we have to disclose this as a risk. This is not, as you do your review of your security procedures and so forth, you're going to have to say to your shareholders, this is a problem.
I see. Well, that would make sense. You know, it's one of those little fudge disclaimers you got to put at the bottom of the thing. We should point out that a brute force attack is still going to take a long time, even if it's 100 times faster. It's still going to take a long time if you have a truly random password. The real problem is people don't use random passwords. They use short, kind of non-random passwords. That's a lot easier to brute force.
I mean, I think any business that's using Wi-Fi ought to be forcing anyone on the network to be using VPN as well, just to be safe, even before they cracked WPA. I would never have relied on wireless for security.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me do a little calculator. This is lastbit.com as a password length calculator. How long is your WPA password, Tom?
I somewhere in the 20s, I think.
Oh, well, I'll just say 15.
Sure.
And we'll say that this brute force calculator, let's say it could do 500,000 passwords a second. And they said now they can use 100 computers at a time. Let's just calculate how long it's going to take. Oh, it's going to take 1,078,485 years. I guess you're safe.
Hey, if you have enough time.
I guess you're safe.
Well, this is AES encryption on WPA, right? We're not talking about WEP. We're talking about
WPA. No, this is strong encryption.
Yeah.
I mean, the only way to crack it is by trying one after another. You can only, the way they do this is you download a bunch of, you have to download the data. You can't sit out front of somebody's house and do this. You have to download enough data and then you have to kind of brute force it, you know, using many, many, the NSA maybe could do this. We should ask that guy.
Any encryption given enough time is crackable.
Right.
I mean, given enough time, you got a billion years.
I think this, you're probably right, Scott. It's probably a corporate weasel word thing. But Elcomsoft probably should get a little ding for scaring people with something that really isn't that scary. 100 times faster is not nearly fast enough. On the other hand, according to Gizmodo, a computer named Elbot has managed to achieve a 25% success rate in the Turing test, convincing a human being that they're talking to another human being.
And is hosting the show today in place of
I am Elbot! Fooled ya. I don't know if 25% success is really going to knock me out. But apparently this is a lot more than ever before.
Well, you need 30 to pass the Turing
30,
test, is that?
Yeah.
So I think they must have used dumber humans for this test. I'm really skeptical about it.
That's a very good point.
Seems like it's so easy to just spring a question on a computer or try to make the computer laugh.
That's a good point, yeah. So you have a panel of people who in a blind test talking to... Do you have to have them talk to a human and a computer to do this?
I think the classical one is just you're talking to somebody and you don't know whether it's a computer or not. And if the computer fools you, then it's passed the test. I don't remember Turing say that 30% was enough of a success rate. I thought he made it kind of more binary than that.
You either do it or you don't.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm not gonna get
and often these tests are conducted by, you know, I am or you know, typing, where the laughter possibility isn't really an issue.
Right.
It's more just and even in those, even with that kind of handicap, it's pretty, in the past at least, it's certainly always been pretty easy to figure out.
What was the one they used to have called? Was it Ethel?
Eliza.
Eliza.
Eliza. That's what I'm trying.
How are you today? I don't know. How are you?
I mean, they have come a long way since Eliza.
I am fine. Fine is
I don't
nice.
Know anything about piss off.
The thing about Eliza was that even it was surprisingly effective, even crude as it was.
Right.
If you had the slightest suggestion to the person who the human being at the other end, that if you told them in advance they're talking to a human being, they wanted to believe that. And they actually were willing to buy that this was another person.
Well, and more than that, you can also, that's why Eliza was a psychotherapist, because then you could say, well, the reason she's keeping to repeating what I'm saying is because she's
that's what therapists do.
That's what therapists do. So
that's what they get paid for.
That's how they work. She's trying to get in my mind.
Yeah, in fact, if you compared to Eliza to psychotherapists, Eliza did pass the Turing test, I think.
Freudian only. Remember that Santa? There was a Santa Claus. This was last Christmas. That something like that. That Microsoft had a Santa bot I dimly remember this on its MSN mail. And after a while, it started inviting you over to his house for, you know, I mean, it was like it kind of had some like got racy. How old are you? Would you like to come over to my place? They shut that one down pretty quick.
Santa learns fast.
It's amazing what artificial intelligence, where it goes. Speaking of artificial intelligence, I'm going to get in trouble for that. Sarah Palin has to save her emails because they were used for state business. Now, this Tennessee kid who's the son of a Tennessee state legislator, used basically social engineering techniques to break into her Yahoo mail. What was it? AlaskaGov@Yahoo.com. Apparently, they had set up email accounts known only to each other. That's a violation. The Washington Post says that Sarah Palin maintained a private email account that she communicated with a small circle of staff members outside the government's secure official email. And now courts are saying that she has to preserve all this email. This is
the kid in Tennessee's got them all for her, so
yeah,
he's good.
He got indicted. Apparently, it's not the first time this kid in middle school hacked into a school computer. So there, watch out. He's a hacker. Shocking. That's got to be embarrassing to the legislator, though.
And he didn't do anything particularly brilliant. I mean, things like
a mother's
maiden name
Where'd you
are
meet
so
Todd?
Easy to find.
Yeah.
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 It's just kind of shocking it's taken this long for people to figure out that none of this stuff is secure in the least.
You know.
Yeah, was it just a dictionary attack on her?
No, he just guessed.
He socially engineered it.
The secret questions were, where did you meet your husband?
So he got the secret questions. That's right. I forgot about that.
So he wrote
that.
Wasala High School. Yeah, that's right. Actually, he tried Wasala High School. That didn't work. So he tried Wasala High. Yep, bingo. It's like when Paris Hilton got her sidekick hacked. Remember the secret question is, what's the name of your dog? Which she, of course, everybody knew because she was on TV with the dog.
Yeah.
Don't use, you know, my answer is lie. When they ask you the secret questions, lie.
Yeah, you have to have an alternate identity that no one but you knows about with a backstory.
You got to remember it, though, because, yeah, you got to have a whole backstory. You got to remember it because they're going to ask you, where'd you go to high school? Muncie. Quickly.
Warsaw, Indiana.
But, you know, I remember, I think it was Bill Clinton who said, I don't use email. I know President Bush doesn't use email. He doesn't, for instance, email his daughters. Not because
Karl Rove got into this problem in the White House.
Yeah, because not because he doesn't know how to use email, but because this is public record.
So they keep trying this dodge of, I'll set up a private account. No one will know and no one will ever find out. And that is, you know, where they get into trouble over and over again.
Yeah, that's ignorance of how the internet works. I mean, I think a lot of people who listen to this show know that you never really want to put anything in email that you wouldn't be able to handle getting out sometime.
Are you not allowed to have she is not allowed to have a private email?
Well, I mean, I'm just talking practically, just having an email account, even if you think you deleted it and shut it down, the email has a way of finding its way into dark corners of the internet that you had no idea existed and then popping up at the most inopportune times. As far as with the legality of her having a private email, I guess she's not allowed, the governor of Alaska is not allowed to conduct official business outside of official channels.
Yeah.
Is that, that's what's going on there?
Yeah, it's true in California. I served on a committee in our local town and there's this thing called the Brown Act and you're not allowed to have, you can't even have correspondence with the other members. It actually is extraordinarily frustrating. It was a tech committee. We were not allowed to set up a forum, exchange private emails, because the rules are against meeting in private, essentially. Anything you do has to be public. Mm-hmm. And I'm all in favor of that transparency. But at the same time, if you're trying to do a tech committee and you can't use any modern technological tools, it's really frustrating. I ended up quitting. Now I understand a little bit better why things take so long in government to happen. So apparently they have an IT guy who set up these email addresses, 10 to 15 email addresses, chiefly the small circle of aides known in Alaskan political circles. This is according to the Washington Post as Palinistas for their fierce loyalty to Palin. They wanted an email system they had control over They also inquired about options for encrypting their email, but gave up when they heard that the commercial encryption product was $1,000.
So, what?
So these weren't encrypted. They were stored on Yahoo's servers.
Just pay a little money to get POP access to Yahoo Mail and then PGP it.
I believe Hushmail is free, but okay.
Or Hushmail, yeah.
Obviously, they need a better IT guy. Anyway, they're going to have to preserve all those emails. It would be hard. But answer my question. Scott, maybe you know. Can the president of the United States have a private email conversation with his daughter?
I am not a lawyer, but my understanding is that, yes, you can have a private account to have private conversations. But if you're doing anything related to government work, that needs to be, needs to comply with all the rules. And the rules involve the preservation of public records.
I think Bush said he was concerned about a freedom of information request.
Yeah, well, that you preserve the records so that sooner or later they can be used by historians or the general citizenry. It's their, we're paying them and they're doing our business and we have a right to know how it's proceeding.
Yeah, but that's a burden that you have to consider as in public office, that you really don't have any privacy.
I certainly understand the impulse to go around an IT department that doesn't give you what you need. I mean, I did that in my previous job.
They
took away our email system at Tech TV, so we just went to Yahoo Groups.
Yeah, we didn't want to use Lotus, so we made our own. But that's the difference between being in public life and being a web producer at a small time cable network.
That isn't even publicly held.
I'm going to talk just a little bit about the Android phone and amazing sales figures for the Android phone. But first, I want to thank the folks at GoToMeeting, our sponsors today on the show. GoToMeeting, I've talked about it before. I use it all the time. It is a online meeting system that is just swell. Easy to use, very easy to set up. Just took a couple of minutes to set it up. You can do it right now. Go to GoToMeeting.com/twit. A couple of clicks of the mouse. Within a couple of minutes, you'll have it set up, Mac or PC. And then it transforms your meetings. Nobody wants to travel these days. Who wants to get on an airplane, go through security, take off your shoes, get the middle seat? I talked to a friend of mine is going to Japan today for a meeting, like a 2-hour meeting, and then flying back the day after. It's 11 hours each way for a 2-hour meeting, not to mention the cost, the time. David, go to meeting. You got to learn about go to meeting. Here's what happens. You set it up on your computer. Then during a conference call or ahead of time, if you want, you can send out an invitation via Outlook or any email program. But it's so simple. Even during a conference call, you a couple of clicks of the mouse and now you're on the phone and you say, look, I want to show you this PowerPoint, or I got to show you these documents, or this is so cool. Let me show you this. I want this website. I got this great YouTube video, whatever it is. And you say, okay, go to GoToMeeting.com. They say, okay, enter in the meeting ID. Boom. Oh, there's your computer. They see your computer on their desktop. You can show them anything you want. You can give them control. It's great for training, for sales, product demos. I used it, as I mentioned, just a few weeks ago to rehearse a speech with somebody. They were in L.A. I was up here. Awesome. Try it for free for 30 days, a month of unlimited online meetings. Go to GoToMeeting.com/twit. If you've never tried this before, try it free for 30 days, and I think you'll see why. I don't travel anymore. I stay here. I use GoToMeeting. GoToMeeting.com/twit. So, Harry, have you ordered your G1?
I have not. My understanding is that they gave first dibs on them to people who were existing T-Mobile customers. Yeah. But I might well be in line now when the rest of us can get it.
I'm really disappointed. I emailed contacts at Google. They said, yeah, we have a limited number. We'll send you one for review. It'll be embargoed, but you'll be able to talk about it before it goes on sale. And I didn't get it. And I sent a note to the woman. She says, I'm on leave till October 27th. It's like, no, no, but I did order one. I have a T-Mobile account, so I will have one October 22nd. I'm very excited about this.
I got more excited when I saw the launch than I thought I was going to be.
Yeah. It's wide open. Look, we're not alone. It looks like they've gone through two, they had the first round. All the pre-orders sold out. T-Mobile tripled their original request from HTC. A second round sold out as well. The number of pre-orders sold out combined to be about 1.5 million units. This is according to Pulse2.com. 1.5 million units pre-sale. That's, Tom, is that bigger than the iPhone? I think it is.
Pre-sale, I think it is, yeah. Because I don't think they hit a million until what, like 18 days or something?
Why?
Why is it so? Because people are out there dying.
Oh, you sat on your mute button again.
It was Apple. They were trying to stop me.
You can't say it, Merritt.
And I think people out there are dying for an alternative to the iPhone. So, you know,
it's cheaper.
Had to take somebody. I mean, there's the LG Dare. There's the Samsung Instinct. These are actually really exciting to some people, but nothing that's really captured imagination. But you put Google's reality distortion field of their own behind something, make it look decent, like it's, you know, it's usable and it's got cool features. And I think that's why people are getting so excited about it. It's weird to me because it's on the T-Mobile network.
But I think
the BlackBerry
also
Storm will also be a big deal.
Oh, yeah.
Storm will be a big deal, too. You're right.
And it's on Verizon. I think there are a lot of people who are hungry for something cool, which is on Verizon.
You know why I want the G1 and not the Storm? I want the keyboard.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. A lot of us don't want a keyboard.
Yeah. And I think a lot of people just hate the idea of switching their carriers. Even if they hate their carriers, it's just such a pain. And they're just, you know, sort of, if there are T-Mobile customers, they're sitting there saying, well, I would like to have an iPhone, but T-Mobile's not giving me an iPhone. Oh, now they're giving me this. Hooray.
Yeah, it is sad because the T-Mobile, for most of us, will be Edge. In San Francisco, Tom, you'll be able to use their 3G network. I don't know how fast it'll be. They have it, I think, 22 markets, something like that. They will have 3G networks. In fact, they won't sell it in the stores, in the T-Mobile stores, unless the market that they're selling into has 3G.
Well, that's good.
But you can order it, as I did, from a market that doesn't. So I'll be using it on Edge. I'm not, you know, I can live with Edge speeds if the thing I'm really interested in. First of all, you buy music from the Amazon Music Store, unprotected, 256 kilobit. I like that.
Mm-hmm.
There's going to be an app store. I'm looking at already what's out there on the Google App Store on the Google page. And these look pretty good. You know, you can download an emulator and play with them, and they look pretty good. It's got GPS. It's going to have a lot of the features that the iPhone has. It's got a real keyboard. A little clunkier. It's not as elegant. Has any of you played with the Storm?
I haven't got my hands on one yet.
You know, there's this weird thing going on. It's not haptic. I thought it was haptic. It's not haptic touch, but you have to push to click. It's got a spring in it.
The whole screen presses down.
Mm-hmm.
What a terrible idea.
Really? I like that. Again, I haven't put my hands on it yet, but I like the concept of having a little tactile feedback there.
But it's not haptic I get excited about because then you could feel the controls. But, you know, you have to push to click instead of tapping. What's wrong with tapping?
Well, that's too much effort to push.
It's too much effort to tap?
Well, with the tapping, though, you don't get any real feedback. I know with the haptic, you get a little bit, but
the whole,
you get that visceral,
the whole screen moves.
I feel it.
It's a giant button.
Yeah.
I don't know.
It doesn't bother me at all.
Well, we'll see. I guess we'll know when we get it.
The people I know who have touched the Storm are relatively enthusiastic about that approach. It does sound bizarre, though.
I think what's going to be really interesting is when you start seeing Android phones on the other networks. When you start,
right.
Because I think you're right about Verizon. The LG Dare has been the most popular review on CNET for the past 3 or 4 months. And I think that's simply because it's a Verizon phone and that's kind of like the iPhone. You get an Android phone on Verizon, it's going to go through the roof. There'll be an Android phone, you think, eventually for almost all the carriers. Will AT&T get one?
I bet they will. Motorola says they're making them. The only company that's not making them is Nokia. Everybody else has agreed to make them. So there are going to be a lot of great choices. I am, as somebody who's ordered one, I like the idea that there are 1.5 million others who have ordered them because that means there's an ecology for the App Store. There'll be developers moving to it. It's an easy platform to develop to. It's Java. I think you're going to see a lot of applications even from the Apple Store ported over.
Google is not going to be out there killing apps, right? I mean, as far as we know,
it's totally
open.
You could put up your own web page. You don't have to go through the store. I could surf to your web page with the G1 and download it right there. There's no requirement. I think the store is important. Is it T-Mobile or Google? I think T-Mobile is running the store. I think it's important that you have a store. I think that for novice users, you know, that's one of the things that makes the iPhone very attractive is you can just go to that store and browse and buy. But I think for advanced users, who cares? I mean, BlackBerry, for years you've had over-the-air downloads from websites. It's not a difficult thing to figure out. I actually am excited about it, and I'm very excited that the sales are so high. I think that that's a good sign. It means that this will be a strong competitor. I've used the Instinct. I haven't used the Dare. I'm totally unimpressed. I'm still an iPhone. I'm an iPhone user until I see this G1.
Yeah, the browser's the killer on the iPhone, I feel
where,
like.
Where's the bold?
I just wrote about that. I wrote several times about the fact that the bold was supposed to be out from AT&T during the summer at about the same time the iPhone 3G was, and I was really impatient about it. But just this last week, Orange in the UK, which had been selling the BlackBerry Bold, pulled it off the market and said that the software was just not reliable enough.
That's bad.
And so I blogged again, and I said, well, maybe AT&T did the right thing by not putting it out until they felt like it was ready for prime time. But I think for a lot of people, the Bold is going to be an exciting phone, too, because it truly is sort of a BlackBerry that's part of the next generation of phones. And in terms of dots per inch, the resolution is higher than that of the iPhone. And it has a real keyboard.
Everybody raves about the screen. I haven't seen it, but everybody says the screen is gorgeous.
I saw the Bold, gosh, back in the spring when I was still at PC World, and it did kind of knock my socks off.
Is there anything besides these phones, any dark horse that's going to come out of nowhere? Anybody got something coming that's, you've got to figure, it's been a year and a half since the iPhone came out. Every company. Where's Nokia on all this? Why is
there's
it?
Nokia has the 5800 Express Music, which is yet another sort of iPhone-like phone. And Nokia has this, comes with Music Plan, which lets you download all the music you want for the time you own the phone. And that looks like the closest thing that Nokia has come up with to an iPhone killer.
And then they've got their own open platform to try to compete with Android now that they've opened up Symbian too.
Symbian needs a lot of work, though, to sort of be a modern phone operating.
It's a little 90s. I was a big fan of the Scion. And the,
me too.
Yeah. In fact, in a way, Harry, I'm kind of hoping that this G1 will be a Scion.
I've been looking for a modern Scion since they stopped making Scions years ago. It had a better keyboard than any modern phone does by far.
Yeah. I love my 3A. I would still use it if it were a little more modern. That's what I'm really hoping from the G1. I'm looking at this Nokia. It looks just like an iPhone. It couldn't be more like an iPhone.
Yeah, I mean, I remember when they first announced it, everybody was joking that they just took an iPhone and photoshopped it to be a Nokia.
It looks like it's got this roughly the same size, same screen, it's kind of same bezel.
Somewhat better camera.
That's one thing the iPhone really lacks, that 2-megapixel camera nowadays. The G1 will have a 3-megapixel, but come on, let's get a real camera in one of these phones.
No, all you want is 2 megapixels.
Really? Why?
Because that's what Steve Jobs said.
Oh, of course. I'm sorry, Steve.
You don't want more than 2 megapixels.
Don't ever retire, Steve. Please, we love you.
The Nokia also has an FM radio, by the way.
Does anybody want a radio? I don't need a radio. I've got about 4 radio applications on my iPhone that are far better, including many radio stations that are far better. Who needs a radio?
I need an AM radio. Well, I never put an AM radio. It's always an FM.
I never do. But I'm telling you, that's why, look, Tom, on the you have an iPhone, right?
You get the AOL radio app.
AOL radio, Pandora. That's but then there's also this from Null River. The reason I know about it is because we're broadcasting on it, is Tuner Internet Radio, which has hundreds of stations, including our station, which is twit.am/listen. The Clear Channel just put out one called iHeartRadio that has half. It's kind of silly because it only has about half a dozen stations. But if you want to listen to one of those stations, it's there. It's pretty amazing, I think.
It's just all about coverage versus FM in those cases. I'm not sure how many people really want radio on their device anyway for
don't
real.
Don't you want Pandora instead of an FM station?
If you do, AM and FM are a little better coverage than 3G and Edge sometimes.
Oh, okay.
But
I guess.
I don't know that it makes that much of a difference. It's one of those things I like to have. When I had FM radio on my phone, I used it from time to time, but I don't terribly miss it that I don't have it.
Well, if I were a satellite radio, I would just be, I'd be if I, XM and Sirius, might as well just give up the ghost. Who's going to pay?
Truckers.
Truckers. Yeah, but I listen in my car on edge to our station all over town. I guess if you're in the middle of Utah.
There aren't enough truckers to pay down their debts.
They can't.
On this company.
Truckers aren't going to pay for Howard Stern $500 million. It ain't going to happen.
It's not enough to keep a business going. No. Yeah, it doesn't seem like it. The other rumor that dropped this week is that that Microsoft would be making Zune software for all of its mobile operating systems, and so a lot of people were putting two and two together and saying the Zune phone would come out of that effort.
Yeah, Zune phone. Oh, that'll be big. That's going to be huge. Well, it actually is a good point that Microsoft's Windows Mobile, which does power a lot of phones right now, is starting to look like S60 as a much of an also-ran, Palm as also-ran.
Uh-huh.
I mean, they're just really not in the game at all anymore.
And there are these rumors that the next generation Windows Mobile has been delayed again until I think 2011 or something.
Are you going to PDC, Harry?
I am. And that sounds like it's going to be a good show because it's going to be the first time that Microsoft really talks about Windows 7 in any great detail.
And Live Mesh. I mean, I think this is going to be the Live Mesh show.
And Windows Cloud, which
right, whatever
Walter
that
talked
is.
About a couple of weeks ago, and nobody is quite clear what it is.
But Strata. Apparently, it's going to be called Strata. I think actually that's
Cumulonimbus. They can call it
little puffy cloud. I think that there. I think this is. You know, I don't know if Microsoft will be able to turn it because this is a big turn for Microsoft to go from desktop based operating systems and software. But boy, this is the cloud computing is the future, and if anybody could really kind of throw a lot of weight behind it, it's Rayazi and it's Microsoft, and I think I'm very intrigued about what this Live Mesh / Strata is going to be. We'll do a special show after PDC. Maybe you'll join us, Harry. I hope you will. Paul Thurrott, Jerry Pornell, we have you too. Certainly, there's a lot of attention to Windows 7. I wonder if Windows 7 will ever ship. If cloud computing really takes off, who needs an operating system?
Windows 7 may well be the last sort of Windows as we knew Windows for the last almost quarter century.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I kind of think so, too. I think they will ship Windows 7 just because they're so far down the road with it. But they may actually do with Windows 7 what they intended to do originally with XP, which was it'll be the Microsoft experience, and you'll just keep adding to it, and it'll extend into the Internet.
There's Midori, which is a project to build whatever replaces Windows whenever that comes that Microsoft has talked a tiny bit about. But I think it has to be real someday.
Isn't Midori a melon liqueur?
Yeah, Midori margaritas are quite tasty.
Also a famous classical musician.
Huh. Oh, I wonder. So are the next editions of Windows going to be named after classical musicians or liqueurs?
any combination, that's what it'll be named.
Microsoft as. Yo-Yo Ma. No. Maybe Microsoft Schnapps. That would work.
The great classical musician Schnapps.
Schnapps. Herbert Schnapps. All right. Let's see. There's one more story. I don't know if you're going to get all head up about this or not. I am. I think that, it's appalling what the cell phone companies charge for text messaging. And somehow they miraculously all came to the same price together without colluding in any way. 20 cents a message, which translates to $1,500 a megabyte. Now, that's not enough. Verizon has announced that starting November 1st, they're going to charge 3 cents for the other side. So if your bank or your airline or Amazon is texting you, not only do you pay the 20 cents for the incoming message, but they have to pay 3 cents per mobile terminated message. It's called a mobile terminated message charge. And I wonder if that's just enough. Maybe it's enough to kill spammers. Maybe it's so much that it'll kill all of this. Do you get your baseball scores sent to you via text message? You following the World Series that way? I am. I don't know if people will continue to do this if it's going to cost them 3 cents a message.
Yeah, Goog 411, all of that stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, and I guess the way I read it, and I don't know, maybe Harry or Scott Nopes better here, but I believe the termination rate on Verizon was a penny, and so they're essentially quadrupling the price. They're raising it 3 cents.
It was less than a penny, yeah.
That's my understanding. It reminds me of ATMs where I get charged by
both
my
ways.
Bank and the other bank. It seems like they can make enough money off me once, and they don't need to double dip, and it might just kill SMS.
I'm sad. I had a dream that Google was going to buy this 700 megahertz frequency stuff. They were going to set up kind of an open new style wireless communications, and using voice over this wireless thing as well as data, and just put these guys out of business. The cell phone companies are just appalling. They're rapacious. They're worse than the record companies.
Yeah, well, I think the Google that was going to be able to do that was the Google whose stock was, 700
right.
or whatever it was.
Not anymore.
Sadly, I think, that the prospects of that sort of building from them are not good now.
Hey, we went through this whole show and didn't mention the stock market.
Sorry.
Wait, what's this? What's going on with the stock market?
I don't know. I hear things. I don't know.
I just keep bars of gold under my bed.
Jeez.
So
isn't it interesting how you're watching CNBC and all of these Forex ads start showing up? Get into the foreign exchange business. Or I'm waiting for the Franklin Mint to start up again. Gold coins in the backyard.
You might have a fortune in your closet.
Is it? We talk about this every week, but is it scary for the tech industry? We've seen some layoffs this week. eBay fired 1,000. Smaller companies like Seismic laid off 9. Are we going to start seeing that? It seems like it's a little early for this to impact the tech industry.
Everybody's getting ready for it. I mean, everybody who has any venture capital investment is in a mode where they're going to spend as little as possible and just hunker down.
Well, obviously, it's going to affect everybody, right?
It's tightened up a lot, isn't it?
This is not going to leave anyone untouched, but the more capital investment you need to run your business, the harder it's going to be. I mean, the things that I was reading at the end of the week last week basically were saying, if you're a small startup, your venture capital funding may push on you to be more efficient, but it should keep coming. If you're in green tech or biotech as a startup where you need huge capital outlays, that's where you're going to really feel the pinch.
Too bad. That's what we need the most.
I always think of the crash of 87, where I, in fact, worked for a small tech startup. And when it happened, the president called us all together and said the good times were over for a decade to come. And he laid off a third of the company. And within a matter of months, that crash, the stock market was back to where it was before that happened and boomed thereafter. So I think even the smartest people are not that great at predicting the future.
Yeah, who knows what's really going to happen, I guess. But, the market for books about blogging is going to go through the roof. There's no doubt about it.
That's all people will have left to do after they get laid off.
Well, blogs, the cost of starting a blog is what, less than zero. It's just your time. Hopefully, a lot of blogging actually started during the last downturn.
That's true.
It took off during the last downturn.
A lot of people at home.
Exactly. You had all these people in the tech industry who were unemployed and putting a lot of their energy into kind of just keeping their name out there on their blogs. And so I all joking aside, I think it is strangely a kind of a recession-proof industry, since it's not really much of an industry at all. It's the cost, costs are minimal, and the only thing that it really takes is some kind of passion or insanity.
Kathy Sierra actually was saying that on Twitter last night, that that was the last downturn that got her changing career, mm-hmm. and that got her doing what she's doing now. She's grateful in a way.
Yeah,
I think it depends on how you support yourself by your blog. I mean, I think if you're operating in some sort of micro economy of your own, and I think of people like Jonathan Colton, where, they're getting the money direct from their fans for what they produce. I think that is very recession resistant, mm-hmm. Because people still want entertainment, and it's not that costly to pay 99 cents or so for a song and to go out and see a show. You might be able to afford that. I think if you've got a big blogging enterprise that relies on advertising, I think that advertising money is going to dry up a little bit for a while.
Is it, you think? Technologizer is Federated Media, right?
If the advertising market just dies, it will be bad news for me, but my costs are low compared to even a salon or not, let alone something like PC World. I don't have dozens of people. I have me and a few contributors who are not on staff.
I appreciate you not saying CNET.
Hey, you're a CBS joint now. You can't.
Yeah, that's true.
You can't go anywhere.
Well, thank goodness we have a papa.
I would hope, and certainly as a podcaster, I hope that advertisers would see new media as a more targeted, more efficient, more less expensive, more valuable proposition and maybe flock to it as opposed to abandon it.
I think they will. I mean, I think the newspapers are, and to some extent the broadcasters are in much, you know, have a lot more to fear right now than the small, you know, smaller, nimbler online publishers, because people understand that, you know, this is where this is where the growth is, and there's growth even in a downturn, you know, and they're going to be looking to spend advertising dollars as smartly as they can.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I don't think the advertising market is just going to die. I think it's going to, they're going to be a little pickier about where they spend their money. And that, you're right, that could benefit certain blogs and podcasts for sure.
Seismic, I'm sorry, laid off 7, not 9. I apologize.
Now, was Gawker talking about laying off people?
Gawker had some layoffs.
Gawker really cut the staffs very heavily at the blogs that were not the most promising advertising vehicles.
But, you know, he does. Nick Denton does this every 2 years or so. He declares that there is a recession coming, and that's kind of his shtick. And he may, you know, this time he happens to be right. But his whole modus operandi has always been to talk down the future. Blogging is never going to make anybody any money. He's been pulling in his horns ever, you know, on a regular basis for a long time. So, you know, I don't take that as a real bellwether. I just see that as
that's just Nick.
His natural behavior.
That's just Nick. He's cheap.
Well, this guy is falling. Oh, wait, look, this guy's actually falling this time.
Woo. Rafe Needleman on his Webware column on CNET wrote about companies that might be gone in this big recession, and Twitter, he put Twitter among them,
and Meebo, which is a great service and one which I really hope does find a way.
Meebo's like Facebook kind of, or MySpace.
Meebo is instant messaging that works entirely within the browser, and it's very well done.
I was thinking of Bebo, not Meebo. Yeah, Meebo is Tripit, he mentions Zillow, Pandora, of course. Here's a surprise: Second Life. You know, Second Life has a revenue model. You pay to be part of it.
Yeah, it's just a matter of whether people, if enough people are paying, which I think is questionable right now. If the economy turns down, it could dry it up really quickly. I think what he's saying in this column is these are the companies that have to really act. It's not necessarily that they're done for.
He's saying Twitter has
to
find a revenue model if they're going to succeed, if they're going to survive, I should say.
I mean, at least Meebo does have a revenue model. There is advertising there, and Twitter has kind of had the luxury of not seeking one yet.
And so you think maybe their investors will say, okay, no more money. You got to come up with some way of making money. Skype, here's an interesting one. Skype, eBay has already made noises about selling off Skype, which it bought for an astronomical amount of money. But Rafe points out there's nobody going to buy it at that price, so they can't sell it.
Yeah, they'd have to take a loss on it at this point. And I don't think it really makes sense for eBay. They had all these ideas of how they were going to integrate it into the auction process, and they never really took advantage of that.
Here's the biggest surprise: MySpace.
What's the logic behind that?
He says, although it's generating a lot of revenue and under the aegis of Rupert Murdoch, the notoriously ruthless businessman could easily cut loose. Oh, he's thinking Rupert could cut loose MySpace.
Yeah, I asked. He was on Buzz Out Loud Friday, and I asked him about that one particularly. And he said he thinks that Rupert is impatient. He'll dump stuff if it starts to turn sour quickly. And he thinks that MySpace could start to be a little rocky and that Rupert might ditch it.
That the momentum is against them.
I'm not sure I entirely agree with him. I think that thing is so huge. I don't think Rupert's going to dump it as quickly as he might dump some other things.
I think if you're Rupert Murdoch or any sensible businessman, this is the time that you say you hunker down, you reduce the spending as much as you can, you prepare for downtimes, but you use this as an opportunity to build audience and to build market share. It's actually a great opportunity. I think Jason had said that a couple of tweets ago. This is an opportunity if you can survive it. So the key is hunker down, not spin off or get rid of. Well, we're going to get rid of ourselves here because I think we've talked enough about the tech of the week, but I am so glad we could get all three of you on here. Scott Rosenberg is working on his new book, you have an ETA? I know you said your deadline is December 1st.
Yeah. It will be out next June or July of 2009.
Oh,
that's the target.
Isn't publishing lightning quick.
Yeah. And this is considered a fast turnaround.
Isn't that amazing? Is it a little frustrating after working online?
Oh man, that's the hardest thing. But I force myself to take a very relaxed Zen attitude, and I figure, you just have to accept that the printing presses are in their own, their own space, and that's just what it takes. It's just a different it's a different way of being.
You never did answer Harry's question. Who was the first blogger?
Oh, well, he was, obviously.
Justin Hall, some say.
I really don't think there is any one person. I think Justin Hall is in my book. Dave Weiner is in my book. Jorn Barger is the guy who invented the word weblog. And it was an evolution, right? Each of these people contributed something, and it all kind of coalesced over time into what we call a blog today.
I remember having Justin on. Justin helped us, didn't he, Tom, early on in Tech TV as a consultant? I remember having him on Call for Help.
Yeah, I think he helped. I think he talked with David Miller in that era.
Yeah. He came in a kilt.
Yeah. Yeah. He always had a great outfit.
Yeah, he was a great dresser. And then I remember we had him on Call for Help, and we went to the front page of his blog, which featured a full frontal nude picture of himself, which was, I think, the first time, not the last time, that happened on Tech TV. And we were live. So,
yes. Yeah. I remember that one.
So it's funny, though. I mean, blogging isn't that old. I mean, it's recent memory that it was born.
Kind of. And yet the people, people in the industry are just very forgetful of recent history. They just aren't interested. And it seems to me that all of the things that these bloggers learned are lessons that, people are needing with each new turn of the wheel in the industry, whether it's Facebook or, whatever it is that we're doing, it's the same lessons about how to behave online.
I agree. So, in fact, I look with great interest for the book, because I've been saying for some time, podcasters, internet broadcasters should look at the history of blogging if they want to know what's going to happen. Mm-hmm. I mean,
there's so much stuff that just never changes. I mean, I was on BBSs in the late 70s.
Right.
That was not such a different world from the world of blogging in a lot of ways.
No, I ran a BBS in 1984, MacQ, and it's very similar. This stuff is really, it just keeps coming around. Well, I can't wait to see it, and I wish it were coming out sooner, but Scott, we'll have you back when it comes out, if not sooner.
Great.
Yeah,
thanks
really
so
appreciate
much.
It. Wordyard.com is Scott's blog address. Harry McCracken is the technologizer. The technologizer. Yeah. The machines ruled the world. And you go to technologizer.com to read about, I like it because it's very personal. There's you have the CNETs of the world, the PC worlds of the world, where you have kind of, reviews and, but this is about you and about your relationship to technology. And frankly, I like that.
Thanks a bunch. Yeah, I'm having fun. I'm also signing up other people. I have some new writers too, and I'm looking for folks who have that personal touch.
All right. Technologizer, a smarter take on tech. Buzz Out Loud is the definitive tech news podcast, a must listen every single day of the week. Tom Merritt and the lovely Molly Wood.
We try to fill the gap between twits for people.
You do a good job. Too good a job. Would you stop it?
The weekend is yours.
Knock it off. Yeah, thank God we divided that up early on. It was a good thing we had that handshake.
I think we got the harder part of the bargain.
Yeah, you do it five times a week. I'll do it once. But I'll do it for a lot longer.
Yeah, there we go.
BOL.CNET.com, a must listen. And thank you.
A pleasure as always.
Oh,
thank you.
Oh, it's great to have you on. Always a good time. Thank you all for listening. We'll see you next time. Another twit.
This is amazing.
Is in the can. I should have paid attention. I don't know what I'm going to do. Too much work. The problem is, there's no limit. My server's completely collapsed. So here's the deal. I'm just trying to get the thing up, but I have a hell of a time. What blue screens like?